Headlines.
From Washington, D.C., the capital of the divided states of America, it's time for the show that brings you both sides of the issues you care most about. On the right, I'm investigative journalist and Donald Trump supporter Lee Stranahan.
And on the left, I'm political analyst and progressive Democrat Garland Nixon.
This is Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan. In the first round today, the Trump administration is saying now that it's going to reconsider the Iran nuclear deal. Is this another foreign policy flip-flop or some great strategy by the president? Then in round two, the Democrats poured a lot of money and a lot of resources into a special election in Georgia, only to come up short. They could not get 50%. Is this the sign of what's to come in 2018 or more media hype? And finally, in the third round, Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. I know you're sad about this, Garland. Fox News host Bill O'Reilly is gone at Fox. There have been recent media shakeups on the right, including The Blaze, now Fox, and Breitbart News, something I know a little something about. Is the right-wing media having trouble becoming the establishment? Or will they rule in the Trump administration? That and more coming up today on Fault Lines. Hey, Garland, how you doing today?
I am fantastic. Better than Bill O'Reilly. How's that? No,
yeah,
actually not. He probably just signed a deal for like, you know, $30 million for severance pay. So
Here's the thing. If I had told you who would last longer, Bill O'Reilly or Steve Bannon, I think you would have bet Bill O'Reilly, correct?
I would have definitely been Bill. He's been there like 26 years or something.
That's right. He's been there a long time. But let me tell you something. I don't know what you think conservatives think of Bill O'Reilly, but it's not so like most people I know who are conservatives are not gigantic Bill O'Reilly fans. He gets good ratings. He's been on the show for a long time. He's clearly got an audience.
The number one cable news show.
That's right. But we'll find out if some of that's a function of time slot. We'll find out who gets his time slot. I'm Team Tucker on this. I hope Tucker Carlson gets that time slot. And I will make this prediction. If Tucker Carlson gets the Bill O'Reilly time slot. Now, by the way, it could go to Hannity.
Yes.
If you're doing the pecking order, by the way, I like Sean Hannity, too. But let me make a prediction. If Hannity gets the time slot or if Tucker gets the time slot, they will beat Bill O'Reilly's previous ratings. That's my prediction.
His recent ratings,
whatever his recent ratings have been. OK, not at his heyday, whatever that is, because less people watch TV now than ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, does that make sense? So it's going to be hard to top that. I'll tell you something else. If Shepard Smith gets the time slot.
Yeah, I'm thinking the numbers are going to go down.
They're going to go down. They're going to go way down because people really don't like Shepard Smith. And if it's Shepard Smith and let's say Joe Scarborough comes over from MSNBC, Fox News will get negative ratings. I don't know how that's possible. Here's how
they'll
I think it is.
They'll owe extra viewers. There will be like 10 viewers that aren't even watching them that will have to be factored into other programs.
It means there's going to be more host than viewers. It means Shepard Smith will be watching the one viewer on Periscope and then going from there. But anyway, we'll be talking about that in the third segment. Let's talk about this Iran deal.
Okay.
Let's talk about that. Now, look. Well, give me your take first.
Okay,
let me
start here. A couple of things.
Because I'm going to have something to say.
A couple of things here. And as you know, I felt, be honest, there was things that Barack Obama did that I didn't like. There was things that he did that I did like. One particular thing that I was in favor of was the Iran deal. And I think, well, here was one of the issues I had with the Iran deal, and I'm with people who opposed the Iran deal, and I'm hearing that come up again. And that was, well, but Iran still sponsors terrorism. We can't possibly make a deal with them on nuclear weapons because they still sponsor terrorism. Now, here's the problem, and you know that's coming. We know that's part of the argument against it. And here's what I have to say about that. Well, not coming. It's been lurking out there for quite a while. So here's what I have to say about that. It was determined early that the most pressing issue was nuclear weapons, right? So the people just like raised the bar. So President Obama said, man, yeah, you're right. The issue's nuclear weapons. Let's strike a deal with him. They got in six other countries, got together. They struck a deal with the Iranians. The Iranians, it was determined they had gotten rid of like 98% of their nuclear material, almost all of their centrifuges. Even President Trump, even their latest review found that they were in compliance with the deal. Okay. And now we have people starting again, but they're doing other things. Here's the way I look at it. If you make a deal for the most important thing, it comes across as disingenuous. If you say, we've got to stop them from getting nukes, you stop them from getting nukes and you say, yeah, but they got a bow and arrow over here too. Oh yeah, but they're still doing other things. I think they're separate. And that's why I think it's disingenuous of those who simply don't want any deal at all with Iran. Now, you know, the neocons, my, you know, arch enemies, there's nothing that could ever happen in a deal that would prevent war that the neocons would be in favor of. But my feeling is, I think it was a good deal. For those of you who don't know why this happened, the president, well, not the president, but whoever his designee is, they have to make a report to Congress every 90 days regarding the compliance of Iran. And a lot of that information comes with the UN, the IAEA, et cetera. And they looked at it and they said, okay, they're in compliance. So what's not the like, Lee? What is not the like?
Okay, well, a few things. So the first thing not to like is that the Obama administration was horrible at making deals. They were literally, Trump has this exactly right. The Obama administration was very bad at making deals. Now, that being said, let's talk about a couple of other things. First off, I'm much more comforted by the Trump administration re-looking at this deal, because the Trump administration, with one notable exception, that's McMaster, seems to get that radical Islamism, I don't want to get that wrong, but
I was going to say, you're always telling me the word needs to be said and you're screwing the word up. So
radical Islamism
doesn't need to be said.
Islamism is a hard word to say. That could be why they're so mad.
So then can we agree that if it's so hard to say, then maybe it's not important that people say it after all?
No, it is important people say it, but it could be the reason that they're so upset is Islamism. See, because you got an ism and an ism in there.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So, but radical Islamism is the scourge of the world right now. It's the biggest single problem in the world, encroaching Islamism. So the fact that the Trump administration is at least realistic on this gives me hope. That being said,
people like Bernie and I would say climate change. But this, I'm just throwing that out there, but let's get back to
it. I know you'd say climate change.
Radical Islamism, ism-isms.
I know you'd say climate change, but I'm going to point out climate change didn't kill three people in Fresno yesterday.
No, it kills like hundreds of – how many thousands of – well, okay, let's get back to the isms here. To our multiple isms.
Okay.
I don't want to get sidetracked just yet.
So is it fair to you call you an Islamism denier? If I would be a climate change denier, can I call you an Islamism denier?
I have to think about that. There's you know, I really have got to run that by an English professor before I can determine if it's, you know, like going to after so many isms, if whether or not the word actually turns around and means the opposite of what you intend it to be.
Well, let me talk about Iran for a second. So Iran, I'm old enough to remember, and Garland's a little old. I'm 51, right? So Garland's a little older than I am.
I'm 173.
And more fit. I'll point that out. Garland's in great shape. Garland goes out and works. There's a gym near here. Garland works out. What I do between things, I take phone calls. That's what I do. That's my exercise. It's a lot of picking up the phone. But Garland's, you know, a little older than me. Anybody who's my age and older certainly remembers the Iran hostage crisis, right? And Ayatollah Khomeini was the first time I knew anything about Islam. That was my first experience with a lot of people my age. That was their first experience. Now, Iran's got a lot of problems. And again, Iran is Shia. And that comes up in a second, because the big problem with terrorism in the world today is Sunni fundamentalism, which is promoted by Saudi Arabia. Let me come back to that. Again, I'm trying to make you a little smarter here. Not you, Garland, everybody.
I was about to say that.
It's going to be difficult
for a conservative to make me smarter.
I just want people to explain it, because here's why I have to explain it. The media does such a crappy job. That's a technical journalism term. The media does such a crappy job of explaining Islam. People don't know the difference between Shia and Sunni, for instance. So you don't need to know everything. You need to know a little bit, though. So Iran has plenty of problems, and they have the religious leadership, and they're the ones who called America the great Satan and everything else. That being said, they're not the biggest problem in the world right now. The biggest problem is the Sunni fundamentalism promoted by Saudi Arabia. And Syria, which we talk about frequently on this show, is basically a proxy war, in my opinion,
between
Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yes.
So what I'm happy about here, this goes back to what I said about Obama making lousy deals. I would much rather have the Trump administration, particularly if we can get some ideological clarity again. And by the way, getting rid of McMaster would be a great way to do that. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. But I also don't think Steve Bannon's going anywhere anytime soon. So if we could get a better deal with Iran, I'm completely in favor of that. And the other thing is, it might chill people out a little bit on Syria, because one of the thorny issues, as far as I'm concerned, with Syria, right, isn't Russia, who everyone's tried to make into this demon, but it's Syria. It's Iran, right? So Iran's involvement in Syria, I'm iffy on. Does that make sense?
Right. It's not discussed. Now, I'll say this. I think, my opinion, you don't think it was a good deal, but I think it was a great deal, because here's the bottom line.
It was not a great deal.
Here's why I think it was a great deal, because here's the bottom line. If we have an issue and we resolve that issue, and let's go back again, because there were a bunch of people who made statements like Benjamin Netanyahu and various people who came out and said, now this guarantees absurd statements. This guarantees that Iran is now going to get nuclear weapons. Oh, really? So a deal that gets rid of nearly all of their centrifuges, that gets rid of 98% of their nuclear material, that guarantees they're going to get it. That's like saying, well, we're going to come to Garland's house and we're going to take all of his guns and we're going to leave him with a butter knife. Well, that guarantees that he's going to shoot people now. It's absurd. And it was just hyperbolic, partisan, ideological mumbo jumbo that meant nothing. But my point is, what is there to examine by the United States? Let's not forget China, Russia, France, Germany, United Kingdom. All of these companies got together. They all signed off on the deal, and everybody was happy with the deal. There were sanctions.
Not everybody was happy with the deal.
At the time, the leaders of all the countries were satisfied that it was a reasonable deal. Okay, now what we look at now is, and they removed the sanctions, they gave them their money back, they let them put oil back on the market, et cetera, right? So now if the U.S. says, you know what, we've decided that we're going to back out of this thing. Well, guess what? We can't. It ain't going to matter, because the rest of the world is not going to reinstitute the sanctions. And for the most part, we didn't release a lot of the sanctions simply because the U.S. still had some issues with what we termed state-sponsored terrorism. I'm not saying, I'm not getting into that. I'm just saying as a nation, we had some issues. The Obama administration didn't fully release the sanctions, but the rest of the countries did. So what? So the United States says, well, darn it, we're sick and tired of that. We're going to reinstitute the sanctions that we never took out. Do you think the rest of the world, you think they're not going to be able to sell oil on the market, and the rest of the world is going to reinstitute their sanctions simply because we back out and it's not going to make a difference? So we can do it. If we want to feel good about, if the Trump administration wants to feel good about themselves, they can make some noise, but they're not backing off of this thing. The only way you would be if you could get the other countries who were involved to back out too, and that just ain't happening. Particularly what's going on right now with the Trump administration's foreign policy, that's pretty much freaking everybody in the world out.
Well, I don't. So,
including you, I might add.
No. A couple points here. Number one, one thing that does worry me here is that I'm seeing places like Vox, like the Washington Post, agree with you, basically, Garland.
That worries me, too, as soon as the Washington Post.
But
that doesn't mean they're not wrong. It just worries me. Okay?
It's likely they're wrong, because they're wrong about most things. But what they're saying is that this was an awesome deal and that Trump, this is a defeat for Trump. I think Trump saying, if the message comes out, look, we're going to look at this deal, and all options are on the table with the deal, which they should be. And by the way, this is one of the reasons Trump's a good negotiator. Read The Art of the Deal, okay? A book, by the way, that I got my 15-year-old son for Christmas because he wanted it. And that's the kind of dad I am. I got my son The Art of the Deal.
I wouldn't need that book because I didn't burn my fireplace much this weekend. It was a very warm summer. Warm winter. So since I didn't burn my fireplace, now it's crab season. I don't have a bird that needs to line my bird cage, but there's crab season coming up, so, you know, I can use newspaper or a Trump book.
Well, this is good because at least you're admitting that progressives like to burn books. This is good.
That one I'd burn. Yeah. That one I would surely burn.
Yeah, I know. I know. There's no books I would burn unless I was really cold.
Trust me, if I wrote a book, when you read my book, you'd burn it. You'd burn it.
I like Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Oh, good. Holy moly.
But if I were really cold, I would burn it because it's a very thick book. That's what I'm saying. So, Communist Manifesto, don't like the book, wouldn't burn it because it's short.
Yeah, I was about to say, if you're freezing to death,
Atlas Shrugged is a better book to burn. I wouldn't burn the Bible because that's wrong. But look, here's the thing. We only have a couple minutes left in this segment, Garland.
Mm-hmm.
The difference here.
What are they going to change, Lee? What do you really need to do? So if you're going to say that's a bad deal, you look at it.
Well,
everybody's agrees that they're in compliance. They've gotten rid of 98% of
the... So you're using an argument that is wrong. Let me explain why.
Okay.
A lot of countries were agreeing with TPP, something that you as a Bernie supporter, I assume, didn't like, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so there you go. So if the argument, the fallacy you're committing here is that somehow, because other countries like it, we should like
it.
No, not that they like the deal.
That they're in compliance with the deal. I've read the deal. I'm okay with the deal.
Well, and
then we can argue whether or not they're in compliance. If you agree with the deal in the first place and someone is in compliance, and not just me, the Trump administration agrees that they're in compliance. And in compliance basically means they ain't going to be building no nuclear weapons.
Right.
And
so, if the goal is to look at it and then renegotiate and get a better deal, which I think the Trump administration is much more likely to do than the Obama administration did, period. Because, again, the Obama administration was crappy at deals. I mean, it's just period. They were lousy at deals. Furthermore, let's go over just real briefly. You've only got a minute or so left in the segment. One of the reasons they were lousy at deals is they didn't do, and this sounds like a cliche, but it's true, they didn't put America first.
Yeah, you're right.
They didn't put America first,
and it's false.
No, it's 100% true. Barack Obama is an anti-colonialist. Okay, he was not an America firster at all. He's an internationalist and an anti-colonialist.
I'm an anti-colonialist.
Well, okay, then I don't want you negotiating this deal.
Trump doesn't, but the rest of the world does because we'll be on a level playing field because people like me don't see the world as a hierarchy and we don't see the U.S. at the top of the hierarchy. We see the world as a reasonable and fair place where everyone is equal.
So what you're saying is because the rest of the world doesn't see the world as America first, even though, by the way, they see their own countries first. Because, by the way, this is a unique position. I mean, the United States.
I think that's projection.
No, it's not projection.
We think America's so great, so we project it onto everybody else. Well, you obviously think your country's better than mine. Why? Because I think my country's better than yours. Dr. Freud on line one, Lee Stranahan here.
America is clearly objectively better. When you come down to what the principles the country was founded on compared to other countries at the time, when you come down to individual rights, when you come down to freedom, when you come down to prosperity, the United States is unique. It is exceptional. God bless America.
We've got to end it on God bless America
this segment. When we come back, we're going to talk about that special election in Georgia, special election. You're listening to Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines. Lines.
Welcome back to round two. The name of the show is Fault Lines with Garland Nixon and Lee Stranahan here live in Washington, D.C. The special election in Georgia's 6th Congressional District has gone into extra innings. The primary Tuesday, Democrat John Ossoff. I wonder if it's Ossoff. I don't know, but it's Ossoff or Ossoff.
It's loser. That's the correct pronunciation.
Well, he actually got 48%, but he fell 2 percentage points short of the 50% he needed for an outright win. So he's now going to face Republican Karen Handel, and they're going to have a runoff June 20th. I think she got about 20% of the vote. But there are a lot of people that think it's going to be really tough for him in Georgia. Now, in the 6th district, which I think Donald Trump only won by a point or two. So this is going to be, it's going to be tough. And let's not forget, a lot of things can happen. There is a political millennia between now and June 20th. So let's talk about a couple of things that we picked up. Number one, he got 40, and I think this is important because one of the issues that we had that was discussed a lot during the during the primaries and during the general election was the issue of polls, where polls, you know, everybody who was behind always said, you know, the polls are skewed, the polls are false. We had, particularly in the primaries, where Secretary Clinton was picked to win Michigan, I think, by like 20 points, and she ended up losing.
Right.
There were a number of things, you know, look at Pennsylvania. There were a number of places where the polling just didn't get it done. And we look here, and we see that the polling was fairly accurate. He was polled at about 46%, and he got 48%. So that was pretty close. So I think in the immediacy, one could argue that the polling was accurate. But here are my thoughts on it, Lee. My thoughts on it is we're looking at the suburbs of Georgia, right? We're looking at suburbs, B, Georgia and Atlanta, a very, very, very red state. And I think we're looking at an area that tends, that's probably going to be more so than a lot of other areas, going to be an establishment area and going to be easier to predict. My thoughts come going into 2018 and 2020 and looking at what happened in the last year regarding polls being off. A lot of times there were places like the Rust Belt. They were places like the Northeast. There were areas where there were large concentrations of people that wouldn't be considered your traditional establishment kind of voters, such as young people, people who were maybe a little on the outside of the ideology, you know, who basically maybe fell along the realm between Democrat and Republican and would vote on other things such as jobs and things that weren't as ideological. So I think a lot of people are looking at this saying, okay, the polling was close to what it finally came out being, and a lot of the establishment media organizations are looking for a way to simply say, things have calmed down, everything is smooth, the polling looks good, we're back to normal politics, and I don't think we're back to normal politics, and I think we have some other special elections, but I see any of them really in areas of great contention regarding the groups I was mentioning. So I still think that when we see another national election cycle such as 2018, I still think it's going to be hard to predict. I don't think it's going to be easy to predict because of the fault lines in the two parties. Like,
oh,
the
well done.
Like the
well played.
Shameless
well played
plug. There. Between on the left, the Bernie people and the Hillary people, and on the right, the establishment, you know, the Paul Ryan, McConnell people, and what were the Trump people. But, you know, although you guys may not admit it, Donald Trump has thrown his lot in with the establishment in the biggest way you ever possibly could. So what are your thoughts on this? Let's just talk about the polling and whether or not you think maybe this is fairly accurate, or am I going in the right direction thinking, you know what, I don't think, though this is accurate, 2018, 2020 are going to be normal election cycles or what we're accustomed to.
Well, so let's get a few things straight here on just the numbers and what's going on. So first off, how red is Georgia? Not that red. In other words, Donald Trump won, but he won the state by about 5 points. Okay, so Hillary Clinton got 45% of the vote. And that's particularly true because cities, big cities like Atlanta, are clearly Democratic. Kasim Reed, is the mayor, he's a Democrat, born Muhammad Kasim Reed, by the way. And so there, of course, religiously, he is a, what's the M word? He's a Methodist. He's a Methodist. That's what he is. But I just want to be clear, because when people hear the name Muhammad Kasim Reed, they might assume he was Muslim. But apparently his father was thinking about converting at one point, named him that. But he's Methodist, okay? So I just don't want anybody to go off on a tangent there. So, but he's a Democrat, okay? He's a Democrat. And Atlanta, because it's a big city, is Democratic, because most big cities are Democratic. Mm-hmm. Most rural areas tend to be more sane, shall we say.
Conservative,
yeah. And but sane, same thing. And so the fact that he got 48% running against, I believe, 11 Republicans. Let's point that out. He got 48%, but the Republican vote was completely split, including a fairly pro-Trump guy, Bob Gray, who was one of the people running, who came in third.
Yeah, but, you know, Bob Gray initially was, he was, if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure on this, he was endorsed by the Club for Growth,
yes.
But then they backed out on him over the Trump Care because the Club for Growth was upset with Trump Care.
Yes.
Because, and I'm glad you know what I mean when I say Trump Care. He was
I'm letting you get away with it. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah,
I'm letting it pass. That's what I'm doing.
I'm mighty appreciative of you. But the Club for Growth, and again, this shows kind of what I'm talking about, kind of some of the intra-party issues going on here in the background. So Bob Gray endorsed by Club for Growth. However, when he was supporting Trump Care, the Club for Growth got mad because it wasn't conservative enough. And then they kind of turned, you know, they got angry and they made some statements about Gray that indicated they no longer were in his corner.
Well, yeah,
I don't know if that had an impact on here. I don't know if it had an impact on this race, but it was certainly.
And Handel, the woman who won, she came up fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing.
Was she Secretary of State or something like that?
She did, but she rose in the polls relatively quickly. She became a real factor in this election, which, look, the reason this happened is because Bob Price, who was the congressman, joined the Trump administration.
Health and Human Services.
Right. So that's what happened. Now, what does this mean for 2018? Nothing yet. I don't think it means anything for 2018. But I'll tell you, the best part of it is that the Democrats blew a lot of treasure. They spent like $8 million, I think.
$8.3 million.
Let it keep going. And as much as they want to spend was great. And they couldn't close the deal. What Ostroff had to do was he had to get more than 50%. And if he had gotten more than 50%, this would have been done. Now, the fact that it's going to a runoff means he's likely to lose. Now, I don't think it's a slam.
That would be my bet.
I don't think it's a slam dunk.
He's 1-1 against the Republican.
You said that yesterday. 1-1 against the Republican. I think he's likely to lose, but we'll see. Now, however this went for Trump, Trump only won by 1%, like you say. But this congressional district has not gone for a Democrat.
Since the Carter administration.
In a long time.
Yeah.
Since the 70s.
What's his name? Newt Gingrich came out of here, out of that 6th District.
Yes.
Yes.
That's why Newt's first album was called Straight Out of the 6th District.
Straight Out of...
You remember...
Straight Out of Atlanta.
That's right.
Out of the A, that was it.
That's right. Not many people know that Newt Gingrich started his career as a Dirty South rapper. Not a lot of people know that. But since I just made it up, not a lot of people know it, but... But anyway, Straight Out of the 6th District was Newt's first album he dropped.
Yeah.
And, but look, here's the
thing.
Didn't
sell a lot of copies of that one, if I remember from the Brothers in the Hood.
No, he would, because Newt's funky. So here's the thing, though. The media wants to make this, and the left especially, wants to make this a big deal. You said, and I think you're right, you said this about the election in Great Britain yesterday. Yesterday, we know Theresa May called for a snap. So we have two. It's interesting.
June.
We have two June elections coming up, right? We have two June elections coming up in Great Britain. We're going to see if the Conservatives can get more seats in Parliament. Probably they will. That's why Theresa May, the Prime Minister, called what they call a snap election.
Right.
We don't really have snap elections here, but they have them in its parliamentary system. And we have this runoff, right? So two elections people will be watching. But if you're correct, and I think you are, that a month and a half is forever in politics.
Who knows what can happen?
Then 2018 is, I don't know what forever times infinity is, but it's big. It's
my
a big
age,
number.
No, yeah, and the other part of it is a major factor is only about 2 weeks away. We got to see what happens the end of April, week and a half here in the end of April, whether or not the Republicans are going to be able to kind of get their act together and keep the government open. Because it's never good for anybody to come. Somebody, when the government closes, it's never good. And there are a lot of issues going on and what's going to happen with the government with a potential government shutdown. And particularly if there is a government shutdown and it never even gets to the Democrats, where it's kind of like Trump Care, where they can't agree enough in their own caucus to get the votes they need to keep the government open.
Well, there's two points to be made about
that.
First off, there's two ways.
And which countries Donald Trump launches missiles at, because we know there'll be a minimum of 12 between now and June.
Okay, so there's two. I'm going to be genteel again and ignore that. So there's two ways in which the government shutdown is good. First one, obviously, is that the government is already too big. So whenever we have a government shutdown, what we find out inevitably is that it wasn't as bad as everyone was freaking out and acting as though it would be. Because first off, they don't shut down essential services. That always gets saved. Every time this happens, this is like the ninth time there's going to be a freak out about the government shutdown. But again, there's two points about this. Number one, the government's already too big, so it's shutting down. Cool. As far as I'm concerned, that's fine. And the other one, and this one is perhaps more important, traffic in Washington, D.C. is awful. So if they shut down the government, Garland, you're going to be able to get in and out of here in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, I tell you, your first argument is one that Ted Cruz used a few years ago. And then after the government shut down, he said, I didn't have anything to do. The government shut down. That's the Democrats. That's Obama. You know, he went up to Tortilla Coast and argued for a government shutdown with the House. And then after the government shut down, he said, I had no intention of shutting the government down.
What did you just say?
That Ted Cruz went up to Tortilla Coast in Capitol Hill and met with the House Republicans.
What is the Tortilla Coast?
Yeah. Oh, you don't know. You haven't been on a hill unless you've eaten a Tortilla Coast. It's a little restaurant there in Capitol Hill, right above the Rayburn Building there.
I have not been there.
Oh, you got to go there. Well, Ted Cruz can tell you about it. They all met in the basement. They just opened a second one, in fact, here in D.C. But the food's pretty good.
Okay.
But at any rate, the long and short of it is that people who ideologically dream of a government shutdown on Capitol Hill, once they get one, they're like, uh-oh. This ain't work. Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, it costs a lot of money. So really, economically, fiscally speaking, it's not wise to do because it costs the government. And guess who pays all the government's bills? It actually costs the money, a lot of money from the taxpayers. But my point being
Wait, you're making a cogent political point, but I'm still stuck on Tortilla Coast. Hang on. Let me just slow your roll for a second. Isn't it so? It seems to me sort of un-American that Ted Cruz would meet.
That.
Couldn't he go to Freedom Fry Hut? Isn't there something... I'm just saying.
The America's Best Buffet. They got one. American Steak and Buffet out in Waldorf. That's a thought.
Or a barbecue place. Barbecue, the American cuisine. Barbecue, by the way, is America's contribution to world cuisine. God bless it. I'm a huge barbecue aficionado. Couldn't he go to a barbecue? Does he have to go to someplace named Tortilla Coast?
Tortilla Coast. Ted Cruz. Maybe you guys better take a look at this guy.
I may need to. I'm an investigative journalist. I may need to investigate, particularly if they have carne asada. But okay, but go on. Make your point.
Yeah, so the bottom line is my point being, I get back to what I'm saying, there are a lot of things that can happen between now and June 20th. And the other part is this. You know, every time something happens, we had the Kansas special election and everybody said, well, that means this. Now we have the one in Georgia. Oh, that means that. Everybody tries to take each one and run with it and spin it and use, you know, create new rhetoric. The bottom line, I think we got about 5 or 6 special elections. Really, until they're all gone, I think we can look back and evaluate them. I think the next one's in Montana. And once they've all been evaluated, but right now, I don't think any particular one does anything but give both sides a reason to cheer and say, hooray, we're making a move and the other people are going down. Now, what can we tell you? Historically, what we know is that generally the party that goes in the White House takes major losses with few exceptions and maybe about the last 35 or 40 years. With few exceptions, the party that goes into the White House generally takes a beating during the first midterm. So if I had to predict something, you know, consistency is always your best bet. So that's what I think is going to happen. Now, let me say this about that. And here's what's importantly. This is what I'm preaching to people on my side. What's really important over the next 3 years between 2017 and 2020, governorships and state houses, because 2020 is a census year. And guess what happens? The states redraw the lines. So if the Democrats can take a bunch of state houses, that's what I'm preaching to the Democrats. If they can take, not that, you know, the people who run the Democratic Party, I have no use for anyway, but I'm saying this regardless. For, I guess, both sides should be considering this. Well, not the Republicans. You guys don't pay any attention to it. Just the Democrats. Okay. At any rate, the House is solid blood, fire engine red because of redistricting, because they have the houses and they have the legislatures and the governorships throughout the country, and because they can redraw the districts on their behalf. I want the other people to be able to do that, and then the Democrats can have a chance to get the House back. But based on the Democratic Party we got, I'm not even happy enough with the Democratic Party I have now to know if I'd even be happy if they got any of it back. I just know I'm not happy with the Republicans having it.
Well, here's the thing that I think could affect the 2018 election that a few people are talking about, because no one really wants to deal with it.
Tortilla Coast.
You're close, actually. Okay. It's very close, actually. The effect of Donald Trump's immigration policies, which are causing less people to flee over the border and actually causing some people to leave voluntarily, could change the demographic makeup, because I'm one of those people who agrees with Donald Trump. I don't know if the 3 million number he said is correct. But there is a tremendous amount.
Neither does he. He just made it up.
No, he didn't make it up.
Donald Trump, he'll just say 10 million, 3
no,
million,
no,
5 million, whatever.
Didn't,
what does he care?
He didn't make it up. The system, clearly, when you have a voter system that doesn't require ID, it's open for undetectable fraud. So we know for a fact that there have been illegal aliens it's not hard for them to vote. With things like motor voter and stuff like that, it's not hard for them to get ID. It's not hard for them to register, and it's not hard for them to vote. So I think one of the factors that's going to affect things, and again, no one wants to talk about it, is that if Trump is able to get his pro-American, anti-illegal immigration agenda through more, I think a number of places, Texas, New Mexico, not California yet because it's so tipped, but in other places, if you see people leaving, this is how we'll know whether Trump was right or not. If you see people demographically leaving who are illegal aliens, and then we see a big shift in those vote totals in those areas, we'll know that Trump was right and that clearly illegal immigrants voting was a big issue. Right? And again, I know you're a progressive, Garland. You're going to be in denial about this, but that's one of the things we have to look forward to.
If the GOP plan is to thwart the illegal alien vote, the undocumented immigrant vote, yeah, my gosh, you got me using your own language, the undocumented immigrant vote.
That's so good. You were actually accurate there for one brief second. So it was awesome.
If that's your plan, then
here's what illegal immigrants, by the way.
That's an easy one. So you guys go move forward with that plan. The only problem is I can't get the Democratic Party to move forward with a plan that is related to policy for a change. If they could just stop yelling, we're not Trump for a while, then maybe we could get something. So you guys will be chasing undocumented immigrants that can't vote. Our guys will be running after. We're not, you know, running around telling everybody that they're not Trump. And
well, that's because the Democrats don't have any policy.
Will take
but,
it.
But we're out of time for this segment. Coming up next, more political discussion on Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Fault Lines. Fault Lines.
Back for the third round. You're listening to Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan, much to Garland's chagrin, because he's been on Bill O's show. He's been on Bill O'Reilly's show.
I have. Also, all you have to do is go to YouTube, and if you do a search on YouTube for Garland, Nixon, Bill O'Reilly, you'll find three or four times I was on there.
And by the way, it does not involve sexual harassment. And I know a lot of the Bill O'Reilly stuff, but there's nothing between Garland and Bill. He's never... There's no loofahs between you and O'Reilly?
No, I have no allegations of sexual harassment against Bill O'Reilly.
Well, it's his loss. Let me just say that. I'm trying to say it's his loss. But look, Bill O'Reilly
I'm one of the few people on earth who don't. How's that?
So Bill O'Reilly is out at Fox. It was announced today. It's been building. This is another, look, O'Reilly, in a sense, has only himself to blame for this one. It's not ideological. It's over allegations of sexual harassment. And there's a number of allegations of sexual harassment that have been going around Fox.
And by the way, let's be honest, for years. I mean, this isn't new. You know what I mean? There's been things going on with Bill O'Reilly allegations
for quite a
long time.
And here's the difference. At other networks, is there sexual harassment? I'm sure there is. But what happens with other networks is that people just tend to marry into, like, the Obama administration. We've seen that before, where, for instance, they don't sexually harass them, but they just sort of get married into it. And it's all one big family anyway, because if you're in the mainstream media, unless you're at Fox, you're probably connected to the Democratic machine anyway, right? So the Clintons or something like that. So, but look, this was not ideological. But let's make the issue a little bit bigger.
You know the funny thing here? Being a progressive, this is one area where you and I are going to agree. CNN, or as we progressives refer to it, MSHRC. Believe me, the progressives, the Bernie people, have no use for the CNNs and the MSNBCs. So when you start saying that they're all owned by the Clinton administration, the Clinton Foundation, the DNC establishment, we will agree with you. There is. That's, you know, it's hard to argue anything other than that. So for different reasons, we agree on that particular point.
Right now, but here's what's happening, and let's just relate it to a wider issue, okay? And I'll relate it to my own personal saga because I ended up in the news for it a couple of times. Here's what you got. You got the Blaze recently let go. Tomi Lahren, I'm going to get her name. I always get her name wrong because I don't know her at all.
Because I always say Tommy.
Tommy. Yeah, I think it's Tomi is the way it is. Tomi Lahren. I only recently figured out how to pronounce her last name. She's more millennial, okay?
She wasn't sufficiently orthodox enough.
That's right. But here's the thing, though, by the way. This is an interesting thing to note about the right. I'm just giving you a note about the right. a lot of people on the right are pursuing millennials, and they have been pursuing millennials for...
Yeah, Bill Riley was pursuing millennials. In fact, that's what got him thrown out.
Oh, my gosh.
I had to slip that
in
there.
That was too easy.
You threw it right down the middle of the plate.
And by the way, I think they were in the same age range.
Okay, all right.
But a lot of people on the right have been pursuing millennials, and this is why, by the way, Breitbart was so let's talk about that. We had Milo out at Breitbart. We have O'Reilly now out at Fox. We had Milo, who was controversial and got a lot of headlines. I'm mixed on Milo. I like Milo personally. I really do. I used to work with him. I know Milo personally. When I've dealt with him, he's always been nice to me.
And I have nothing but pity for Milo.
Well, now, why do you have pity for him?
Let me be square with you. Okay, why do I have pity? Because I've read some of the statements that he's made, and that he's gay, and he's used the most derogatory language about gay people when referring to himself. You know, I may be a, and then he used the most horrible language in the world. I may be a blah, 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 but I hate the left. I think that demonstrates to me a person who's got some real internal demons.
He was referring to himself as a British cigarette, I think.
It's something like that. Okay, yeah. But to me,
I'll
when
let
a
you
person
look that up on Urban
uses
Dictionary,
that kind
everybody.
Of derogatory terms about themselves, that's indicative of some serious internal. So here's the progressive, you know, I've got to have empathy for Milo, where everybody, you know, popular to hate Milo. And instead, I'm going to say, look, the guy had some real internal demons. If you talk about yourself, I mean, if I talked about myself in the way that Milo talked about himself, I'd say, you know, you got to take me straight down to a therapist somewhere.
Are you saying using the N-word if you refer to yourself?
Exactly. Exactly.
May I disagree? If you referred to yourself as the N-word, you would be a very popular hip-hop artist.
Well, see, yeah. Well, now, here's the thing
You'd
I got to say.
Like
but that's the difference.
Zillionaire.
We're talking about language. But there are contexts in which Milo could use that word. The word that he used, it starts with an F. There are contexts, if he was around a bunch of his buddies and it was in a different context, they could use it. He can use the word, but in the context that he used it in front of an audience saying, I may be a, and then blah, 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 but I hate the left. I just say, hey, man, this dude's got some issues. So I can't hate on the person who's giving me a cry for help.
Let me continue on the N-word thing for a second, though, because, again, you and I are both of a certain age where we remember Richard Pryor, okay, where Richard Pryor was the funniest guy in the world. When he was doing stand-up, when his stand-up specials came out. Now, what was interesting is, and I'm old enough to remember this, I'm sure you are too, his first stand-up special came out, and he used the N-word on albums over and over.
Yeah,
Bicentennial N-word, right? Like it was the 1976 album he did, right?
That was the name of one of his albums. N-word's crazy.
Exactly right. That N-word's crazy, right? So boom, 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 right now. Then what happened was he did his second stand-up movie special.
Yep.
And he said, I've stopped using the word. And that was a profound moment, I thought, because it was funny. And Andrew Breitbart was a big Pryor fan, too. We used to talk about this. But Pryor deciding to stop using it was profound because he explained why. He said, I used to throw the word around. And then he said he went to Africa and he realized that's something you put on yourself. Then what happened was, and I was joking about Newt Gingrich and saying straight out of Sixth District, but then NWA came. And I remember, again, I'm old enough to remember this, where hip-hop went through an era where Public Enemy was the biggest. Public Enemy, very political group. And then suddenly NWA came out and changed the nature of hip-hop. And suddenly gangster rap came out. NWA was effectively the first gangster rap group, effectively. Mm-hmm. And Snoop came out of that and everything else. And boy, that's just changed. And so since then, since the late 80s, which is when NWA dropped, suddenly the N-word is everywhere in hip-hop. You can't do you see what I'm saying? So we went through an interesting thing in entertainment with this, where a guy like Pryor used it. They used it on Saturday Night Live. Remember the sketch with Richard Pryor and Chevy Chase?
Mm-hmm.
That was a fantastic sketch. You couldn't do it today.
No,
couldn't do it today. So the argument I'm making here is just that when Milo uses it, it's a form of anti-political correctness. And I was okay with that.
I didn't hear that in the context that he used it. I really didn't hear it in the context that he used it. I don't think it was healthy. You know, he was in front of a bunch of conservatives and he yelled, I may be a, and then he used referred to a sexual act, and then he used that name, but I just, as I heard it, I thought, nah, that ain't good. But well, that being said,
there's other issues with Milo.
Yeah.
And it's part of why he's no longer Breitbart. But the broad thing is, there's suddenly this new focus on right-wing media. And I, like I say, I was part of it. When I left Breitbart about a month and a half ago now, it was public. I left for reasons that I consider valid journalistically. I've quit Breitbart before, and I quit over stories. Mm-hmm. I get fired over stories. And I'm always right on the stories. So if I'm not allowed to do my work as a journalist, I leave. That's what I do, because I think you have to. Now, this thing with O'Reilly, what's happened, though, is I got to say, it's better. What I'm seeing happening is better. O'Reilly leaving, I thought that Milo leaving, it would have been better if Breitbart had nosed into doing more serious journalism, but okay. They have good journalists over there. There's a number of journalists who I like. And I love Raheem Kassam. I like Brandon Darby's doing on the border, et cetera, et cetera. Glenn Beck had already lost a lot of his audience. O'Reilly being gone at Fox, I say this as a conservative, fine, bye, nice to know you. I hope he gets replaced with Hannity Tucker, and I hope they get replaced by somebody more anti-establishment.
Did it seem to you that he was kind of a one-note Johnny? As I said, I went on his show a couple times, and it always seemed like it was the same thing, political correctness. Like, every show was about political correctness. Like, he didn't really, in the interest of transparency, I've been on Fox a lot. I used to be on there every week on Eric Bowling's show, and back since starting 2010, 2011 in New York every weekly. So I've done a lot of Fox. But it just appeared to me that he was stuck on political correctness all the time. He was stuck on what people were saying, not that he just didn't get into a lot of policy to me. That it was kind of, I mean, is that the way it, that he didn't get into anything substantive or meaty? Sometimes it came across to me like I'm watching the National Enquirer.
Well, that's because Bill O'Reilly's a guy who used to host Inside Edition, right? I mean, his background was more Billy Bush than Edward Murrow. Does that make sense? I'm not even knocking it. Glenn Beck's background is he was a morning zoo host. Before he got into politics, Glenn Beck was a morning zoo host. Does that make sense? And so, I mean, I'm just saying that's really who they are.
By the way,
Beck's compensated for because Beck does read. Beck reads a lot. Right. So, for instance, I know people who know Beck.
That tells me something about the network. You could argue, well, he was an Inside Edition guy. He was a National Enquirer, Morning Zoo kind of guy. That's why he got the numbers, because people want that National Enquirer stuff. Or you could argue that the networks tend to put somebody like that in their most opportune position. They give them that 8 o'clock hour because that's what they want there in the 8 o'clock hour. You could argue either way or a little of both.
Well, look, my big hope, though, is that it makes conservative media better. I hope that, like I say, Tucker is so much better than Megyn Kelly. And I don't just say that as a...
He's considerably more conservative than Megyn
Kelly. He's more conservative, but he's a better host. When Tucker is in there, boxing these people, it's great. People want to see somebody take on the guest and be polite, but do because they don't even do it that much. I was going to say someone like Maddow. I mean, you need somebody who's – Matthews is pretty good at this. Chris Matthews will take on his guest.
You're talking about people that I don't have I would sooner watch Bill O'Reilly than I would watch Rachel Maddow miss everybody. She spends her whole time searching every piece of paper in the studio. She lifts up to see if there's a Russian under there. I get sick and tired of that. And Chris Matthews, who, well, he's a neoliberal. He's an economic conservative is what he is.
But he will scrap with his guest.
If they're if they're progressives, he'll scrap with them.
He was vicious and unfair to Michelle Bachmann, so you should be happy about that, because
I'd probably be vicious and unfair to Chris Matthews if I ever got the opportunity to, which is why I'll never get on MSNBC. Heaven knows after. Isn't that something? I'm a progressive. I'm on the left. I'm a Bernie person. And I could get on. I've done Fox. I don't know how much I've been on there over the course of the years, probably hundreds of times. Couldn't get on CNN. Couldn't get on MSNBC. But I could get on Fox a lot. I've been on.
Here's why. Because Fox is, in fact, Andrew Breitbart used to say this to me. Fox is, in fact, when they say fair and balanced, a lot of people on the left go, no. Right. But in fact, they are more balanced. Forget fair for a second. In that, they'll invite people. And they used to do this with Andrew. MSNBC would have a segment that's basically, Andrew Breitbart, is he a evil racist jerk? That would be the segment. And do you know who they wouldn't invite?
Andrew Breitbart.
Exactly right. Which my whole thing is, if you're going to do a segment about Steve Bannon, at least, even if he's not going to show up, at least invite Bannon. If you're going to do a segment about Andrew, if you're going to do a segment about me, let me on, right? They don't do that. Fox, on the other hand, the reason you are on Fox a lot, aside from the fact that you're good looking, but
aside, I come cheap.
Aside from that,
you're
cheap.
That probably had more to do
with
it.
Well, people don't.
I was on Fox with Andrew Breitbart one time.
No, that's right. We talked about that before. But people don't know this, by the way. When you go on CNN or Fox, what kind of check do you bring in for that?
Usually nothing. Unless you're a contributor, usually, you know, they say, hey, you should be proud to be on.
That's right. If you're a guest, well, I've done CNN a couple times in the last week. I've done MSNBC. You get nothing. And that's fine. What you get is you get a platform.
You get exposure.
You get exposure. Yeah. You get to go out and hopefully get your side of the story out. And that's why I did it. And that's why I was happy to do it. But there's no money in it. By the way, that confuses my mother-in-law, and I love my mother-in-law, and God bless her. But she would always be like, well, why is Lee going on this show? They're not paying him. Why is he doing that? And it's like, well, the reason you do it is because you're trying to build a platform, and if, like me, you have ideas you believe in, right? You have ideas.
Well, the other part, it's like, and I'm sure you do it all the time, too. I get a call sometimes from someone who has a radio show in L.A. or Seattle or New York. And they say, hey, can you come on to talk about this and such, right? And what I do is this. I go on, and you know why? Because I enjoy doing it.
Yeah, right.
And because B, I feel like I have things that need to be said.
Right.
That need to be heard. Things that I need to say that need to be heard. Kind of like an artist. An artist paints. You got a lot of artists, great artists that died paupers. They painted because they loved it. And people like you and I love this stuff. We read the news all the time. We do this stuff. Kind of like Michael Jordan used to always sign, in his contracts, a lot of times in NBA contracts, they'll say you can't play pickup games because you could get injured. Michael Jordan went, oh no. He wanted to be able to play anytime he wanted. He wanted to be able to pick up a basketball and play with his buddies on the corner if he wanted to, because he loved to do it. And I think that's what happens with a lot of journalists like Lee and I. That's why we have fun doing this show, because we really believe this stuff.
Yeah, well, and let me add to that. Part of the problem, let's circle back to the problem with O'Reilly leaving. Part of the problem is that the people who run the networks right now, the people running Fox, they made a
Somebody is actually running Fox? I'm not so sure.
No, there is. They made a good move with Tucker. But they should get some more anti-establishment people on. You and I have talked about this before. Who had the biggest crowds in the election?
Bernie and Trump.
Bernie and Trump, exactly right. So you'd think if the networks cared about money, they'd go, gee, we should get a show with a Bernie supporter and a Trump supporter.
Right.
As far as I know, we're it. You and I
pretty much
are it. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
To me, if I were running CNN, I would have looked at the size of the Bernie crowds, even if I didn't agree with him. I would look at the size of the Trump crowds, even if I didn't agree with him, and said, I see some money here. You see what I'm saying?
But, you know, here's the issue now, unfortunately. And that is, and I make this point. You look at MSNBC, they're owned by Comcast. AOL.
That's true. No, you're right.
Time Warner, they own CNN. Now the problem is a lot of media companies, they don't need to make money off of their media outlets. The media outlet is a mouthpiece. The real money is made with the parent company.
That's
so
right.
We may think, oh, they want more. They don't care if one or two people are listening. You know, I watch some of these things and I look at some of the advertisements and I'm like, who's watching an advertisement for an F-35? Not me. They're not advertising that for me. And they don't care about me or you.
Well, and the other issue that they've got is that TV viewership in general is down. I used to work on Access Hollywood.
I was a graphic
artist 10 years ago on Access Hollywood. And I saw NBC slowly start to go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
It was slow. First, they reduced the hours at the cafeteria. Then they cut all overtime, right? This is right after the financial crisis, mm-hmm. right after TARP. And I could see what was happening, and it's real simple. Less people are watching TV, and more people are watching it on their tablet or on their phone or whatever. That's what's happening. And so when you've got an older demographic, they've got more expendable income because they're not raising kids. They make more money.
Mm-hmm.
You should be making more money when you're 55 than when you're 25. You should be, right? That's the scheme of things. And your kids may be grown. I got like 19 kids. My wife and I have had 7 kids. I will give the actual number. You know, my youngest kid is 5. Okay. And I'm 51. And that if I add up, if I do the math of how old he'll be when he's 18, how old will I be? It just makes me sad. But most people, I also have a 24-year-old, right? And so
even if you don't include him, when you just think of being that age, that'll make you sad.
That'll make me sad, too. But Bill O'Reilly has appealed to that older demographic. I hope they put Hannity in there. But the big question remains, what will the right-wing media do now that they're really part of the establishment? Now that Trump is in and the Republicans control both the House, how will they operate?
Yeah, that's a big question. And so now they're part of their. So now all we've got is three big establishment outlets, and people like you who are people like you and I who are outside of the establishment aren't going to be too happy.
That's right.
We have to find other ways to express ourselves.
We're going to keep doing what we do, which is a Bernie supporter and a Trump supporter here on Radio Sputnik. We're here Monday through Friday. We will be here again tomorrow. Garland, great show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Until next time, you're listening to Fault Lines with Nixon and Stranahan.
Lines.